This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 322 was recorded on May 5th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. Feliz Cinco de Mayo. This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by FarmTogether.com, where you can hedge against inflation and protect your portfolio by investing in U.S. farmland, now available to all accredited investors. I have a couple of announcements, and we'll have a slightly different show format this week. In recent weeks, I've been using the phrase World War III quite a bit. Patrick and I discussed this after our last show and agreed to avoid that terminology going forward. The reason is that so many people equate those three words with certain nuclear Armageddon, and that's definitely not what we're talking about or predicting. I myself failed to seriously heed Mike Green's prescient message when he told me more than a year ago that he believed World War III had begun a year earlier than that. I dismissed the comment as hyperbole at the time because I thought he was saying nuclear Armageddon was imminent, which is not what we've been talking about. So going forward, I'm going to use the phrase conflict of the superpowers to describe the escalating geopolitical tension between the United States, Russia, and China, the primary nuclear superpowers. What seems to be lost on a large percentage of society is that this situation bears zero similarity to past wars between the United States and Iraq or Afghanistan. We're talking about a rapidly escalating conflict between three nations which each have the firepower to literally end human life on planet Earth if they chose to. Now, that doesn't mean that we expect or predict that outcome. What it means is that the stakes are really, really high, and the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine has a completely different escalation risk profile than prior conflicts in the Middle East. We considered using the phrase the new Cold War, but unfortunately, I don't think this will be cold. We already have a hot conflict between Russia, a nuclear superpower, and Ukraine, a country which is receiving aid from other nuclear superpowers. So this is bigger than the Cold War. It's already a hot proxy war, but it's not the same as certain nuclear Armageddon. So I'll use conflict of the superpowers going forward. Moving on to this week's show, Patrick Serezna was called away on business, so we won't have a postgame segment this week. And that actually gave us the opportunity to air a longer than usual interview with Josh Crum. We recorded this interview about the future of decentralized finance right after Jim Bianco's interview on the same subject. But this one ran long, so it makes perfect sense to air it now when we don't have a postgame segment due to Patrick's travel schedule. Everyone's favorite macro tourist, Kevin Muir, will be joining me as co-host for the Market Wrap. Patrick Serezna will be back next week with another of his infamous post-game chart decks.
And I'm Kevin Muir. Eric, I picked a great week to be with you. Lots happening in the market. I turned around. The S&P was up, 150 points yesterday on Wednesday with the Powell announcement. Now we're down 150. What do you think's going on?
I so miss having you on the show, Kevin, because every time you're on, you end up, before the show is over, I know it's coming, you're going to roll your eyes and use the phrase, well, that's what it takes to make a market. Then like a few weeks later when I'm proven right, you're not there.
That's the great thing. I can just.
I know. You look like you're the smarter guy in the room at the moment, and then when the payback comes, you're not there to take it. Anyway, let's go ahead and hit the S&P. You know, I'm not the slightest bit surprised by this sell-off this morning, which seems to be catching everyone by surprise. The way I look at this is we have all of the ingredients that there ought to be a bear market. I don't understand why the S&P is above 3,000, never mind 4,000. Well, what happened was there was a lot of hard selling and fear going into the FOMC. We had a classic buy the rumor, sell the news, although it was inverted this time. It was sell the rumor, buy the news. And that gave us that pop off of that oversold technical condition right back up to the highest of the short-term moving averages, right around the 13-day moving average, which is at 4261 right now. We got actually up to 4300 intraday at the peak yesterday. And of course, we're back down now because everybody's realizing, hey, after that little pop, there's still no good news here. And there's really no reason to expect a recovery in the S&P. So I don't get it. I don't understand why everybody is confused by this. But what it really underscores for me is we have an entire generation of traders, both retail and professional, who've never experienced a bear market. And I think they're kind of being hit broadside with, oh my gosh, maybe this is not another buy the dip. Maybe it's actually going to be a real life bear market. I read about those in history class. Well, we'll see what happens, folks. But I think the fundamentals are all there for quite a bit more lower to go.
So, Eric, for me, what I think happened was that the stock traders didn't really understand how the Federal Reserve and how the FOMC committee works. And they had talked themselves into one of the most hawkish policy paths that the Fed has ever done. I started hearing talk about 75, 100 basis points of tightening this time. And I kept explaining to the stock traders, it's not going to happen. That's not the way that the FOMC works. And sure enough, when the Powell came and he only did 50, and then even more importantly, when he took off the table for future hikes that are greater than 50, the stock traders said, holy smokes, it's not quite as bad. The Fed's not going to slam down as hard as we think. Therefore, we have to go. We're too short and we have to go and get cover some of our shorts. So we saw a rip-roaring rally. But I think if you step back and look at what Powell told you, he told you that the inflation is the number one goal. That is what they are striving for. And I think what they've said is that we're going to have 50 basis point hikes until financial conditions tighten. And that means the stocks have to go lower. So upon sober reflection, they started selling the stock market the next day. And that's where we are today as we're recording this on Thursday. It's actually one of the worst days that we've seen in a long time. Now, the other asset class that I think was very interesting and very telling was the reaction in the US dollar. We'd had a big move higher over the last month or two, and it looked like that had reversed. But sure enough, today we wake up and we're hitting some new lows in the currencies and new highs in the dollar. What do you think's happening there?
Well, as I told Patrick last week, 104 is kind of a resistance level because that was the previous high from a couple of years ago. I think we're going to see some consolidation around 104, and eventually I think we move higher. Now, Goldman had a note out this week saying the opposite. They think that the dollar has kind of peaked here, and there's plenty of reason to expect the dollar to fade over the coming weeks. I suppose that's entirely possible, but in the long term, the way I'm looking at this is I think that you've got to make a decision. Are we looking at a Russia-Ukraine war that it's a separate independent thing, or is this the battle of Russia-Ukraine that's part of a larger conflict between the superpowers, which will probably involve a China-Taiwan conflict in addition to the Russia-Ukraine conflict before it's over? If you think that the war cycle is going to get worse, I don't see how you can come to any other conclusion other than there's a fundamental bullish driver for the US dollar as global reserve currency until such time as a viable alternative to the US dollar emerges to replace it as global reserve currency. Looking forward to get Luke Groman back on the show. We actually had him booked and had to reschedule him. He'll be back in a few weeks. So I want to get his view. But the way I'm looking at this is dollar strengthens in this war cycle until someday, and it will probably be part of the war cycle. I think that there will be competitors that will be presented as alternatives to the US dollar, probably in the form of a digital currency. When that happens, maybe it's super bearish for the dollar, but that's still several years off.
So for me, I prefer to not look at it so much with the geopolitical lens, but rather as a financial one. And when I think about what Powell is accomplishing with his hawkish testimony and his cranking up rates, we're seeing this US dollar rally. And although it's painful to the other countries, meaning the Europe and Great Britain and Japan, in terms of them getting more inflation than otherwise would be the case, when we look at it from an American point of view, there is no doubt that this is welcome in terms of solving the inflation problem. So I think it's one of these things where we're back to the, it's our dollar, your problem, just in reverse. And today we had a situation where the Bank of England met, and they're really in a quandary. They have 10% inflation with no growth, and yet they're having to not hike as much as they would have otherwise liked to be because the economy is stalling. So I think it's just going to continue, and we're going to see this is going to be part of the financial tightening until it ends up being a point where there's so much pain that Powell has to pull off and pull his foot off the brake. All right, so let's go and move on to crude oil. I'm not going to have much to say. I'm going to listen to your whisperings here because you are the crude oil guru. What do you see happening in that market?
Let's start with EIA inventory, crude oil building 1.3 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma building a very badly needed 1.4 million barrels. The drawdowns were on the finished products, gasoline drawing down 2.2 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.3, U.S. production holding flat at 11.9 million barrels. Now, I still think that higher prices are to come, but boy, the price action for the last couple of weeks has just been crazy. What we were stuck in was a pattern for the last couple of weeks where basically when the next headline comes out that's about Shanghai lockdowns, that kind of brings us down to the bottom of the trading range. And then when you get the next headline about EU sanctioning Russian oil and gas imports, that gets us back up to the high end of the range. And we kind of were back and forth on that. Then this morning, we got the headline that the Biden administration, which just made the most epic sell-off of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which I thought was just woefully irresponsible and reckless, has now announced that they want to buy it back. So I guess the strategy is to sell low and buy high. I'm not sure. They're saying this fall they've recognized, so I guess somebody whispered in Biden's ear and explained that, yeah, this business of escalating conflict between the superpowers is kind of important, and selling off the nation's strategic petroleum reserve. Underscore the word strategic, Mr. President. We need that. Don't sell it off just to buy votes, please. Maybe somebody got to him. I'm not sure. But they made this announcement that just shocked the market higher when it seemed like they were going to be buying back all the oil they just sold. And I think the reason that we saw a pop and drop on that news was at first people were just shocked by it. And then they thought it through and said, wait a minute, this is an announcement about something they're supposedly going to do this fall, like after the midterm elections. Do we really even want to take this seriously? So I think that's probably the reason that we saw the pop and drop reversal. And as we're recording now, early afternoon on Thursday, we're kind of back to where we started before the pop and drop happened. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I still think we go much higher here, but that's going to come with further escalation in this geopolitical conflict between the superpowers.
All right, moving on to gold. I feel like there's two camps. There's those that are looking at the rise in the U.S. dollar and the increase in the front end rates and saying, geez, gold has performed quite well. And then there's those in the other camp that look at the inflation that we're experiencing and the geopolitical tensions of a war in Ukraine, and they're saying, geez, you know, gold really hasn't performed what I'd hoped to be. I was wondering what camp you fall into.
Well, Kevin, I'm definitely in the second camp, and frankly, I'm at the point where I think we really have to acknowledge that gold has underperformed all of the other inflation and currency debasement hedges and has just not done very well in this environment. There's a reasonable argument, though, that said, that maybe we just put a bottom in. Ola Hansen, our good friend at Saxo Bank, just had a research note out this week with a chart basically showing that the longer-term trend line, you know, we've had this kind of blow-off top in reaction to the Russia-Ukraine escalation. Now we've pretty much traded that all back out down to where that trend line was. It would make sense that maybe this is the bottom. So we can keep our fingers crossed. Now, there's another viewpoint that's been circulated, which is people are saying, look, Russia bought too much gold in its efforts to divest its U.S. dollar holdings, and it's likely that in order to fight this war with Ukraine, Russia will be forced to sell that gold in order to raise cash to support the war effort, and so that's going to mean a lot of sovereign selling by Russia, and that could collapse the price of gold. I suppose that's possible, but I think that that concern is misplaced. I think the opposite is more likely true. I think that there could be some short-term truth. Maybe tactically, Russia will be forced to sell some of its gold to support its war operations. But longer term, I think that Russia has a strategy, and I think it's been buying gold for a reason, and it's not just dollar divestiture. Same reason that China has been buying gold. I think that it's part of a strategy, maybe not even a certain strategy, but they want to keep their optionality to consider a digital currency system designed to compete with the U.S. dollar for the title of global reserve currency, and which would be gold-backed. So for that reason, I think there's good reason to think that China and Russia will continue to accumulate gold rather than divest it, although certainly in a tactical time frame, perhaps there's some truth to Russia needing to sell some off. Oil jumped on Russian forces entering another region of Ukraine on Wednesday. Gold didn't even budge on that news. So overall, my take is just precious metals have not performed nearly as well as other hedges in all the areas where precious metals were expected to outperform other hedges. Meanwhile, I'm just getting so overwhelmed with my Twitter feed full of all of these gold bug guys with long-term gold bug Eric Townsend capitulates. Okay, guys, look, I've been publishing articles since 2010. Debunking the gold bugs and all of their submoronic conspiracy theories about coordinated central bank suppression of the price of gold. If you think I'm a long-term gold bug, you are suffering a cognitive disorder and need to see a doctor immediately. Capitulation, as used in financial markets, means you give up on a trade and undo it. I haven't sold an ounce of gold or a single share of the many mining shares that I have. Grow up, gold bugs. If you don't like Macro Voices, Peter Schiff produces a podcast which is designed for people of your intellect. Leave us alone. Macro Voices is for grown-ups.
Eric, you got up today and chose violence.
I don't know. I'm just sick of the Twitter.
Do you know one thing I will not push back, but agree with you on terms of the conspiracy theories? I've often wondered about this idea that they come in on Sunday night and they move it on purpose and it's all part of this elaborate plan. And I'm thinking to myself, if you're China and you're seeing someone big do that, the reality is that manipulating it downward gives you a chance to buy it cheaper, meaning that they could just buy it that day. So ultimately, I'm a believer that the price was going to go where it's going to go. And yes, they might move it around for a day, a week, maybe even a month. But over the long run, if it was really as cheap as they say, China would keep buying it and they would send it higher and it would be a lot higher. Now, having said that, I do believe that this is the next stage of the story. You've talked about this briefly in terms of your talking about a digital currency backed by gold. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think that if you think about put yourself into China's central bank planner and you're thinking about what assets do I own, they're sitting there with trillions of dollars of U.S. bonds and U.S. currency. And you've seen what happens when you go against the West in terms of your politics and in terms of your war. And you saw what happened to Russia. And you think to yourself, I need to diversify this away. And to me, gold is one of the obvious answers that they will do. So I expect that we're going to see the central bank of the People's Bank of China continually on the gold bid. And I think that everyone that's sitting around talking about these moves over the last month, whether it's up or down 2 or 5%, are missing the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that the central banks are coming for the gold. And that is a trend that is going to continue for the coming years and maybe even decades.
Kevin, I couldn't agree more with that view. And let's just be clear, because otherwise I'm going to be just smothered on Twitter and emails. The gold market is absolutely manipulated and manipulated badly. All the spoofing and the things that you hear about, it's all real. It all happens. It doesn't make the gold bug rhetoric any less nonsensical than it's always been. And the issue is just that the gold bugs can't distinguish between the manipulation that does occur rampantly in precious metals markets, as well as most other markets, from their nonsensical conspiracy theories. And I just don't want to cover that stuff on Macro Voices. So let's move on.
All right, let's talk about bonds. Obviously, the highlight of the week was Powell's FOMC press conference and what he was saying. What did you take out of it? And what do you take from the reaction in the bond market? I see that the 10-year is breaking to new highs in yields.
Kevin, last week, what I told Patrick is the pullback in yield below 3%, I thought was round number resistance at 3% even. And what I said last week was, watch out, because if we get a sustained move to a 3 handle, it's going to be a telling sign. You're going to want to put your seatbelt on at that point. Well, in my notes for what to say on this week's show, just last night, I said, here we are at 3.03% on the 10-year. And as I look at my screen right now, it's 3.20. So that's 17 basis points in the last 10 hours or so since I put my notes down for what to say on today's show. Put your seatbelts on, folks. Get some popcorn. The Fed is fighting inflation. I think they need to cause a recession in order to succeed at fighting inflation, and I think they'll succeed in causing a recession in order to do so. And it's going to be really interesting to see how far yields can go as this inflation cycle continues. You know, these things take a long time to get started, but it's a fire that's hard to put out once it starts burning.
Well, Eric, I've been a bond bear for as long as you've known me. I've long argued that the bond market will pose as much risk to many portfolios. And one of the things that I've kind of posited was the fact that people always expected the bond portions of your portfolios to be the ballast, something that you put in with along with risk assets to balance it out. And I've argued that it could become the anchor that drags it down. And I think that's what we're experiencing. We're seeing the bond market lead all these financial assets lower. I think that today even you saw that the selling really started in the bond market and then dragged, went into the US dollar, and finally the stock market came down with it. I think we're going to go, that trend is going to continue when you're thinking about this in months and quarters and years. Having said that, there's a lot of bond bears out there. I see that now I'm not as lonely. I don't get called an idiot quite as much as I usually do for being bearish on bonds. And it really feels to me that everyone that's looking for a bond crash is missing the fact that we've already had one. So although I'm not going to get bullish, I'm probably as least bearish as I've been for a while. I think that we get a pause in here, and I think that it's caused by a tightening of financial conditions that actually eventually causes the Fed to pause. So I think we're kind of on the same page there.
And I will add in, because we're doing a DeFi show this week, that long term, I think the real risk to the bond market is not inflation or yields. The risk is the invention of superior fixed income assets, and particularly superior central bank reserve assets, so that U.S. Treasury bonds are no longer the chosen reserve asset of central banks, because decentralized finance has given us a new tokenized asset which works better and does a better job of solving the same problem. That's years away. That's not months and quarters. That's years away. I predict it's coming, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, at least there's something that I could say. I like to fade you there, Eric, and that's what makes a market.
You got to say the words.
That's what makes a market. I'll take the other side of that trade.
All right.
All right. This week's feature interview guest is Josh Crum, who's joining us for a longer than usual interview this week. Eric, why did we invite Josh back for the show?
Kevin, this started when we had Jim Bianco on earlier this year for a non-DeFi interview, and he mentioned in the course of that interview, oh gosh, I could do a whole hour on where that trend is headed, and we got a huge listener response. People wanted to hear it. So we went ahead and recorded that interview with Jim, and my feeling was, you know, Jim is a classical, old-school, you know, finance guy, doesn't have a background in technology, and I think he's a role model for a lot of our institutional listeners, because I think it's really important to learn where this decentralized finance revolution is going to take us. I wouldn't worry too much about Bitcoin. I don't think that's going to be any bigger than it already is. But decentralized finance and the tokenization of the global financial system is going to be the trend for the next 20 years, and learning about it is really important. So we started with a full interview with Jim Bianco, filling that promise of talking a full hour with Jim about it. But we also wanted to get Josh Crum's perspective. Josh is a guy who's actually in the process of trying to create a new exchange that will eventually be based entirely on tokenized, secure digital bearer assets. So we did that interview. We actually recorded it, I think, the same week that we recorded Jim Bianco's interview. Josh ran long, though, and it was too long of an interview to fit in one of our regular shows. We thought we were going to have to save it for a summer special or something. And then with Patrick off this week, it just fits in nicely. So we're going to go ahead and air it. It was recorded several weeks ago. And this is Josh Crum, CEO of a company that's working in this space, talking about where he thinks the future of decentralized finance is headed. Now, listeners, as I've said before, I really think decentralized finance is a topic that you owe it to yourself to learn more about. But we don't want to dilute the focus of what Macro Voices is. This will probably be the last DeFi episode for quite a while, not because it's not an important topic, but because that's really not our focus. Macro Voices is about macro. That's what we're going to focus on. But I do encourage you to continue your education about DeFi through other learning channels. After this episode with Josh, we're probably going to head back to our usual macro focus.
Eric's interview with Josh Crum is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after a message from our sponsor.
With inflation reaching a 40-year high, investors are looking toward real assets to help safeguard their portfolio. One asset is rising in popularity. Farmland has consistently provided returns more than double the inflation rate since before 1992. How? Because farmland's value is underpinned by its critical role in the global economy. The country's growing population needs to eat. Farmland is well positioned to maintain its value over time, no matter the economic condition. As the supply of arable land in the United States shrinks each year, high-quality farmland should only become that much more valuable in the long run. Interested in adding farmland to your portfolio? Head to farmtogether.com. Farm Together is tapping into the nearly $3 trillion U.S. farmland market to bring unparalleled access to institutional quality farmland through a variety of products, including crowdfunded farmland offerings, 1031 exchange, sole ownership bespoke offerings, and most recently, the Sustainable Farmland Fund. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Josh Crum, the former head of global metals strategy for Goldman Sachs, where he worked with Jeff Currie, now founder and CEO of Abaxx Technologies. Josh, I've been so looking forward to getting you on the program because, quite frankly, as I told Grant Williams on your own Smarter Markets podcast, I don't think most of the finance industry has really figured out this digital asset thing. What's going on is a whole bunch of guys are looking at cryptocurrency and how they can trade it. What can we do with Bitcoin, so on and so forth. And they're also looking for what I would consider to be low innovation ways to make a buck doing something else with digital assets. And as I told Grant Williams, I think what we need to do is step all the way back to what is the reason that we allow these capital markets to exist in the first place. In the case of the stock market, it's supposed to be to promote the efficient formation of capital to finance the growth of businesses and thereby to create more prosperity across society as a whole. And I would contend that if we really stepped back and looked at what is the finance industry and how could we apply this new digital token technology to it, what I call secure digital bearer assets, what should it look like and how could we actually make the planet a better place using this technology? You're one of the very few guys I know who's actually involved in a business that's trying to take on that big picture. So I want to start at the very highest level. What is the finance industry today? What's wrong with it? And how could we make it better by applying technology?
Thank you, Eric, and thanks for having me. Look, I'm really looking forward to this discussion because in many ways that has been sort of the arc or trajectory of my career is looking at these types of macro problems. So, you know, maybe just as a very quick background, I'm actually a mining engineer and, you know, come from sort of an engineering systems background educationally, but I'm also an economist and, you know, have thought a lot about and worked in the finance industry, you know, really thinking about these big macroeconomic systems. And, you know, I've actually, you know, after I left Goldman, one of the first things that I, you know, really got into was the Bitcoin white paper and thinking about this new, call it, you know, triple entry, you know, ledger accounting and really what that would do to finance. I'll admit that I was never particularly interested in Bitcoin as an asset, you know, as a new digital gold, you know, having a metals background, having a gold background. I think they're different commodities with different forms of utility. So I've never actually, you know, looked at Bitcoin in that way, you know, that this is a new low risk store of value. Now, I don't want to start this podcast off on the wrong foot. I actually think there are some absolutely revolutionary aspects to Bitcoin itself, not just the Bitcoin technology, but the actual proof of work and the ledger system that comes out of that. But you know, just in the nature of decentralized timestamps and you know, decentralized computing, I think it really is revolutionary. But I think it's probably important to focus more on the finance aspects, you know, capital formation, rather than get into, you know, sort of a heated political argument about layer one or layer two technologies. You know, I think we can naturally get into some of those aspects, but I really want to, you know, I think you would agree, you know, we want to focus on capital formation and what decentralized computing and digital bearer assets, you know, does to that. So, you know, maybe just to step back for a second, I actually believe that there's still a lot of misunderstandings of some of the core concepts in finance itself, how these financial systems work, where they came from, and ultimately, you know, it's an ever-evolving system. The finance of, you know, 200 years ago was very different from the finance of today. The finance of, you know, two decades ago was actually, I would argue, in many ways, very different from today. So this is a constantly evolving system that really evolves with our political systems. And most importantly, I think it evolves with our information technology systems and just, you know, what voices are heard and what information is sort of spread around the world. So anyways, that's a lot to set up. So I'll leave it there for a second and see, you know, see the best way to take this conversation forward.
Well, Josh, I think this whole topic of Bitcoin and what could you do with Bitcoin and how can you use Bitcoin, boy, 3 gazillion podcasts have covered that in gory detail. I don't even want to bother with that because plenty of people have done justice to that subject. I want to talk about what comes next after Bitcoin. So let's talk about your high-level vision of where secure digital bearer assets, that's this idea of tokenized assets, how does that move beyond cryptocurrencies, which were designed to compete with government-issued money, both into government-issued money, but not just money, other financial assets? How do they get tokenized? How will that revolution occur? Because frankly, as I said in my book, I think the entire fractional reserve banking system, the 700-year-old or whatever it is system that has defined everything in finance for centuries, is ripe to be completely re-engineered. But when I try to get my head around, okay, how's that going to play out? Boy, it's a big problem. How do you see this happening?
Yeah, I think it goes back to really the ongoing digitization and what digitization is doing to the world. And it's really an ongoing process of removing intermediaries, right? So I really think that's, you know, you can lower cost and increase transparency by having much more direct economic relationships. And also, I think in an excellent podcast that you had with, you know, Charlie Magaro on Smarter Markets, you know, about a year ago, you really talked about how the system would change when there's not so many middlemen taking fees, not only for service, but also for layers of risk within the system, right? You know, needing to be compensated for putting up working capital or collateral. So I really think it's that, you know, back to that software's eating the world thesis, it's about changing the nature of disintermediation and how many people sort of take a cut of a transaction along the way. I think that's really where things change. But before we even get into all of that, I think it's important to step back and maybe take a very abridged, you know, version of the history of finance and where those intermediaries came from and actually just sort of the nature of capital formation. Because again, this is an ever-changing system, you know, beyond the IT side of things that I think a lot of people don't really get in context very well. So one of the first, you know, as somebody, you know, as an economic historian, and someone that really tries to understand how these very big system, you know, long cycles work, I would say there's probably 2 books, that are probably the most important sort of histories of modern economics. And that's, you know, Ron Chernow's The House of Morgan and The Prize by Daniel Yergin. So it's, you know, more or less the history of modern banking, and the history of the oil industry. And I think it's actually the interplay of those systems of energy and economy with banking and the intermediaries. I actually think those are probably the two most important systems and history to understand. So Ron Chernow, I think, set up an excellent, in fact, it was probably his later book, The Death of the Banker, where he really summarizes really all he learned in, you know, studying these great dynasties like the Warburgs and the House of Morgan, and really broke it down to, you know, a very simple, a simple framework is, you know, you've got the sources of capital, those that, you know, and maybe talking a little about, you know, where that general capital surplus comes from in the economy. So you got the sources of capital, you got the users of capital, you know, those requiring the capital formation, and then you've got the intermediaries in the middle, you know, those that are really brokering the power between the sources and uses of capital. So I think that's the first most important sort of structural framework to understand is where those middlemen come from and what they actually do within the financial system and where, you know, where that's actually always changing. So again, you know, taking it through a broad sweeping, you know, sort of history of finance, you know, if you look back to, again, the time of the Warburgs or the early House of Morgan with Pierpont Morgan, what you're really looking at is really, you know, the early stages of globalization and mass communication with, you know, the telegraph and, you know, so information networks going global, you know, the rise of you know, energy, you know, more dense energy like oil and transportation, and of course the early industrial revolution. So you had this early globalized world, but you had a political system that was, you know, still very regional and you know, sort of, I'd say the aristocratic, you know, sort of globalization, you know, that era. And so you had these middlemen power brokers that were taking those surpluses of early industrialization that, you know, like actually almost all economic surpluses, you know, they really follow a power law. And so, you know, inequality, you know, is a core part of the system that we can talk about later and, you know, how politics tries to remedy that. But, you know, it was really, you know, a few people that had these networks to take the also few people and power broker that excess capital into, you know, very large capital formations. You know, think about the railroads or the canals or some of the early, you know, energy and information distribution systems. So it needed this power broker, one, to find where that excess capital is, you know, globally, but also to sort of organize and almost in many ways, you know, these middlemen were very important in power brokering what are oftentimes very, very monopolistic networks. So if you think about telecommunications, it's not super efficient to have, you know, 40 of them competing when you can actually, you know, sort of centrally organize a telecommunication network, you know, much better at a consolidated level. The same thing with a railroad, right? You don't really need five lines running the same route, particularly in a fixed, you know, fixed track infrastructure. You know, you don't need 30 different pipelines of natural gas or oil, you know, all competing with each other between one route. Now, there are some areas where that will be efficient, but there are a lot of these structural network, you know, efficiencies in the economy that are almost better in some sort of central planning. Now, what we all know from politics, though, and you know, looking at, say, input-output models and central planning of Soviet, you know, communist Russia, is you know, power corrupts. And so, you know, you still want competition in the system. And really what that role of that sovereign banker played was really to rationalize and on behalf of the sources of capital, you know, to rationalize the uses of capital. So it was competition, but that middleman played a very important power brokering. You know, you look at you know, essentially someone like, you know, Pierpont Morgan, you know, he really was the power broker, you know, between European, you know, sources of capital and the heavy consumers of capital, particularly, the early industrialization, you know, railroads, canals, et cetera. So I think that's from big finance perspective, I think that's a very important thing to understand is the power brokering of the middleman in natural monopolies and oligopolies.
It seems to me, Josh, like something changed. Because when you talk about the early House of Morgan, maybe I'm just falling for the sales pitch. I don't know. But the way that I interpret that history is, look, obviously, these guys were greedy, self-serving guys who wanted to make money, just like everybody else. But what they did, the way that they did that, was to really improve society. They said, wait a minute, if we could design this stock market idea, public equities, as a way to promote the efficient formation of capital to grow businesses, that would allow the country to be more successful. It would promote more prosperity for more people because of more employment. And then somebody comes along and says, we could invent the idea of commodity futures exchanges as a way to allow both producers and consumers of commodities to essentially shed market risk and give it to speculators who want to take that risk, protecting American farmers, allowing them to be much more efficient in being able to know what they were going to get paid for their crops in advance, something that, you know, in other countries, the farmers didn't have that. So they were making the world a better place. And of course, they were getting rich along the way and they created monopolies that serve themselves. That's human nature. But they were making the world a better place. I, for one, am not persuaded that CDO squared and other recent innovations in financial engineering are making the world a better place. What happened? What went wrong? Or did I just buy into, you know, a story that didn't really happen?
No, I think it's a great way to frame it and ask the question, but I would actually probably disagree with you a little bit. I think the world becoming a better place is an emergent property of you know this capitalism, this capital formation, and again this rationalization of you know allocating resources properly, so you don't have four completing rail lines, right? So I think the world becoming a better place is more of an emergent property. But at the micro level, you know, I actually still believe that it is that sort of seeking, whether it's resource rents, Ricardian rents, you know, the surplus capital, and I wouldn't go as far as, you know, the greed is good, and that this is, you know, very, you know, Ayn Randian, you know, sort of the ultimate power to the individual. I think it's a more complex dance between, you know, those that are really, you know, are trying to optimize for either power or money and the sort of the political, you know, democratic, you know, sort of, you know, balances of powers that play out here. So, you know, again, going back specifically, I totally agree with you when you're looking at something like the futures markets in commodities, actually making society a better place because it brings forward, you know, a lot of forward information into the market and allows to take the risk off of the balance sheet or, you know, the ultimate risk of the farmer. So actually let's dive into that a little bit more. And that's, you know, ABEX is our business. You know, we're very much focused on these commodity futures markets because we believe that, you know, better information and better organizing of forward planning, you know, often comes from futures markets. So, you know, what is the fundamental problem of maximizing, you know, crop surplus and storage and distribution? You know, the fundamental problem is that the producer is always going to have more top line price risk exposure to that crop than the intermediaries and consumers. So if you think about it, you know, a wild fluctuation in crop prices, you know, can put that farmer out of business very quickly. However, if you're somewhere in the middle of the supply chain, you can likely pass that on. And if you're somewhere at the end of the supply chain, then like that price fluctuation, you know, although it hurts in the short term, it really doesn't change your life significantly. I'm a metals person, so maybe I'll use copper as an example rather than, you know, say grains. Again, that's, you know, a swing in the price of copper from $2 to $4 can drastically change the economics of a mining project or a surplus that's there. But at the end of the day, you know, the change from $2 to $4 isn't going to really impact the price of a Tesla or impact the price of a nuclear power plant or even a large, you know, electrical grid. So it's all along the supply chain that those risks can be sort of managed and pushed along. So ultimately, you need a speculator sitting in the middle. You know, it's not always just matching supply and demand in the future. You need those speculators that are actually, you know, trying to bet on what's actually going to happen in the industry, in the copper industry, or what's actually going to happen in politics, you know, to change the supply and demand of copper. So that information is what helps rationalize. And when there's liquidity in that forward curve, you know, that copper miner can plan their output much better than if they're just taking, you know, daily volatility. So that mechanism is very important. But one other thing I think it's important to introduce here is that it's not just speculation that drives capital markets and capital formation. Actually, the vast majority of capital is really in the business of arbitrage, right? You know, taking information and applying capital in one place, you know, almost in a risk-free manner, either try to get some free optionality or to, you know, really arbitrage, you know, think about early, or organizing supply chains, right? If I can buy something in one location, and the cost of transporting it to another is cheaper than buying it in that other place, you know, that's a risk-free arbitrage other than maybe some, you know, logistics risk. So actually most of the capital markets is looking for that risk-free place to store capital, whether it's in savings and, you know, savings bonds, or it's in this sort of arbitrage, information arbitrage between one and the other. What's really pushed on the world is this sort of gambling form of speculation, you know, and these instant riches. So, but most of the actual formal industry of capital is involved in arbitrage rather than speculation. Speculation is what they try to sell to other people to move that risk elsewhere.
Josh, something I have to touch on, because you're saying that a lot of this is about eliminating middlemen. Look, the finance industry is basically middlemen. That's what people do in finance. And I think a lot of people are understandably a little bit concerned that maybe all of this new digital technology puts them out of a job. Now, I see it the exact opposite way. And the reason I say that is the opportunity that I see for applying this technology is really to re-engineer some of the most fundamental aspects of the financial system, which, frankly, the people who may feel threatened, I think, are the experts in. I'll give you an example. I believe that the entire tri-party repo system, which is kind of the center of the way a lot of things work in institutional finance, needs to be completely replaced by something much better based on digital bearer assets. Here's the thing. The crypto kids that know all about these tokens don't even know what the tri-party repo system is or what it does. The people who are expert on that and know all about the role of the tri-party repo system and how important it is to institutional finance and what it does and what it's for are in a position to be the architects of a new digital replacement for the tri-party repo system. But to my astonishment, it doesn't seem like many people in finance are seeing that opportunity. Am I just early to think that that's an important thing, or how should people who might be inclined to feel a little threatened by all this be thinking about what it means to be a finance guy in this new world?
Yeah, no, look, I think that's a perfect place to sort of transition from the, you know, the broad sweeping sort of, you know, goals and how finance works into the actual, you know, infrastructure and systems that have been built. So, you know, the last thing in making that transition, so I can answer your question, you know, what's changed between the days of, again, the sort of House of Morgan and these, you know, these big, powerful intermediary brokers between, you know, sources and uses of capital, of course, was really the building of the securities industry, right? Instead of, you know, large, powerful, you know, loan brokering, we really, you know, fractionalized this and got all sorts of, you know, new participants, in both equity markets as well as debt markets and lending markets. And that really came, I would argue, sort of around World War II. And actually, probably one of the largest promoters of this was the propaganda of the war bonds efforts. So you had, you know, much more powerful nation states with the inventions of their, you know, their central banks and their ability to tax income, you know, created a much different source and use of capital system that disintermediated some of the big power brokers. And really, what happened is, you know, over time, more and more of that risk transfer from, you know, the savings of the retail public, you know, in mutual funds, and particularly with the baby boomers and the need for, you know, much, you know, saving for much longer, you know, periods of life, really created a much broader securities industry. So you no longer needed, you know, JP Morgan, you know, negotiating with John Rockefeller for excess savings, you know, to put into the next equities. You know, there was a much more dynamic system on both sides. But that securitization and that fractionalization of all of these different bonds and equity issuances, you know, needed a lot of trust infrastructure. And over time, you know, the early equity markets were just an absolute wild, wild west, right? The entire functioning of those systems was insider information, right? Those intermediators became powerful because they had that inside information. They had access. But over the last 100 years, we've built an incredibly robust infrastructure of market information, you know, from bond rating agencies to equity analysis, you know, buy side and sell side, and all of the market data facilities. So again, this explosion of information has changed the issuance and the sources of uses of capital and fragmented it a lot more. So we can, you know, we can trade it a lot more, and we create all these secondary markets. But the problem is, to get back to your question, you know, as we try to build that system, and every crisis, you know, brings in new regulations to try to, you know, to manage the risk of, you know, whether it's insider trading or some of the, you know, some of the incentive misalignments in Glass-Steagall, you know, there's always this sort of political balance to regulate some of the power imbalances of those markets. And part of that system was the actual, you know, the title, like how you actually own that security, right? How you traded it is one thing, how it gets settled, how it gets custodied, you know, really was infrastructure that was built over many, many decades of fractionalizing the sources and uses of capital. And I think where, you know, getting to the crux of the, you know, the rest of this conversation, you know, where this technology can change things is starts to remove the intermediaries and start collapsing that, you know, that high frequency trading system where you're pressing enter from the 2 days of settlement it takes, and then the custody of where that asset sits. So like we already have, you know, very, very fast trading of markets, very fast, you know, securitization of markets, but the settlement and clearing system, as well as the custody system, there's still a lot of middlemen sitting in there that are taking fees for two things. You know, one is their information and sort of gatekeeping fees, you know, their access fees, but also just the risk, right? You know, all of these different middlemen also have to have certain amounts of collateral and capitalization. You know, again, back to those political, you know, trying to remove risk from the system, you know, they all have to put up capital to be involved in that system and take those fees. So if we can cut the risk and cut the fees, both from the intermediation and also the working capital, then this whole system becomes a lot faster and a lot cheaper. Again, back to the whole software is eating the world. You know, can software remove the risk from those systems more efficiently? So anyways, I think that's where you wanted to go with this.
Well, and I've predicted what I call the digital currency revolution. And to be clear, I think that digital currency is really just the tip of the iceberg of what decentralized finance is ultimately going to deliver. But it's what everybody seems to be focusing on first. And something I think is finally already happening is a prediction I made in my book 4 years ago. As I said, look, there's going to be a new space race where basically everybody's going to realize, holy crap, whoever can come up with the digital currency system that's actually scalable enough that it truly is viable to replace the United States dollar as the world's global reserve currency. The power associated with being in charge of that thing, whatever it is going to be absolutely immense. And I think it creates probably a three-way power struggle where governments, including the United States government, say, hey, wait a minute, this is our monopoly. If there's going to be a new thing that competes with the U.S. dollar that's digital, it better be the digital U.S. dollar. And of course, we've just recently seen the Fed come out with their first white paper saying, yeah, we get it now. We understand we need to focus on this. Meanwhile, The finance industry, the big banks are saying, no, we should be in charge of this. We're the bankers. We're in charge of the financial system. And big tech is saying, bullshit, we're taking over everything, baby. We're going to come up with a digital currency system that's fully integrated with social media and everything else and blows everybody away. And we are going to completely control this monopoly ourselves. Would you agree that there is a formative power struggle or space race between government, big tech, and big banking? Or is it a different race? How do you see it? Do I have the right basic vision? And how do you think it's going to play out?
No, you're absolutely right. Now you're getting to the big question and the big power struggle. And that's really, again, around the unit of money. But I think it's important to separate the technology of Bitcoin or blockchain, because a lot of times these things get lumped together. So when I talk about the technology of money, you have the technology of communications and settlement, right? The actual moving a ledger from it's my asset and your liability. Now it's your liability, my asset, right? So there's communication technology, what we were talking about before. That's about the settlement. That's about identifying who actually owns underlying title. That's custodying it for them in a safe way. So you can't lose that title over time, right? So that's all a communication and settlement technology. So if I think about something like PayPal, or even going back further to the paper check or the ATM machine, these were all settlement and communication technologies to move around somebody's money, right? And the same thing is happening in the securities industry. Is can we move around the communication and settlement of assets? So that's I would say that's a little bit separate from what we know as the technology of money itself, right? What is a US dollar? What is money? And I think a lot of times we often mix those two together and create some issues. So particularly in call it the gold bug community, oftentimes people like to separate the concept of money from the concept of currency, right? So money at the end of the day is an economic technology that, it's actually an underlying title to something where possession is 10/10 of the law, right? So when I have an obligation and I pay you a bar of gold or, I pay you a Bitcoin, something that's a bearer technology where, possession is 10/10 of the law. Your obligation, whatever the contract it was, is final. There's finality. Same thing with a dollar bill, right? A paper dollar bill that's accepted, broadly, is a bearer instrument that once that title is passed, the contract is finished and that's done. What currency is something very, very different, right? Currency is a broad debt-based system where you're just moving around the ledger all the time. The power brokering of what this fiat currency is being moved around all over the place, right? And in both place and time when you look at sovereign bonds and so forth. So I think it's a very important to separate the settlement and communication technology from the underlying unit itself. Of what is the measurement, what is the bearer asset that can settle a transaction. Where I think blockchain gets very, very interesting is that perhaps we can even disintermediate, the fiat currency system itself, right? That you don't actually need to have one common ledger unit. And, you already see this in fintech where someone can go right from a stock, and pay for their coffee in a very quick settlement of basically trading stock for coffee without needing a unit of fiat currency necessarily in the middle. Now, you're always going to need some sort of unit of measurement and some sort of exchange to bridge, the relative value of those two assets. But I think that's where this is going. We can debate that and we can go through that, but I think it's sort of almost a real-time bartering system that emerges through communication and settlement technologies getting almost instantaneous.
Well, I think that really is an essential point, Josh, is you could make the argument that, well, it's so much better to not pay for your coffee with currency, which is just a debt instrument. It's a piece of paper. It would be so much better for the seller of that coffee to actually get, grains of gold. So they have something that is absolutely immutable. It has value that's independent of any bank or any intermediary or any custodian. The problem is it is completely and totally impractical to pay for your cup of coffee with some microscopic sized piece of gold. It doesn't make sense. What's changed is now we have the technology that we don't need all these intermediaries. We don't need the currency system, which is a proxy for real money. We can actually have real money that is a digital bearer instrument. And what I give you for the coffee is real money, not currency. Am I wrong to think that's kind of the essence of this? And I think a lot of people don't really see that.
I think that is right. I think in many ways that that is where we're going with real-time exchange, real-time interoperability between, you know, an exchange of assets and you know, ultimately even in DeFi, right? The automated market making between two digital assets. It could be, you know, it could be a Bitcoin or Ethereum or some sort of digital asset that has some sort of, you know, automated, you know, rule-based market making with a, you know, with a, either a central bank digital currency or a, you know, so-called stable coin. Or again, it could be two totally different assets that aren't normally liquid. But because of the composability of this entire ecosystem, again, you can now trade coffee for a bar of gold or, you know, a barrel of oil, you know, 2 months out, you know, a future, you know, a right for delivery. You know, so I think this composability and sort of, in, you know, exchange for everything may actually start cutting the need for, you know, organized liquidity, you know, of a central banking system. Now, again, I think we're a long ways out from that, but I think that's the concept people, you know, should explore, you know, mentally is why the euro dollar system? Why sovereign bonds, you know, became the ultimate collateral in banking? And ask those questions like, are we on the right track with that? Or do we keep building the interoperable system so that, you know, as title for any things become, you know, fully digitized with almost instant settlement without that risk of all those middlemen, you know, you almost get to a digital barter system. Now I think the futures and prediction markets are still going to be a very important part of that. You know, the economy is not always planned in real time. You need forward information, whether that's in, you know, in various bond prices for, you know, for duration of savings or through futures markets. You know, we talked about the need, you know, the fundamental need to match the mismatch of uncertainty in the future production and delivery of commodities. So I think futures are going to be a very important part of this, but again, I think having real-time exchange of asset for asset, you know, through a very complex system is ultimately where we're headed.
For people that are trying to just get their head around this, Josh, you know, maybe the reason that so many people in finance are only able to talk about the price of Bitcoin and nothing else is because this is so complex. You and I share a vision where eventually secure digital bearer assets transform the entire financial system, the entire market system into something new. Well, that's a really big transformation. How do you see this playing out? What's the roadmap? Obviously, it's impossible to predict, but give us your best guesses. Is it start entirely with currency systems and we don't get to redesigning other markets until later? Or does it all happen in parallel and everybody has to adapt to changes in other parts of the financial system as they advance? How does this all go from here?
Well, I think the sort of wild innovation that you're seeing in the Ethereum network and you know, call it DeFi 1.0 or you know, alpha, I think this is actually starting to show and there's sort of emergent, you know, trends that are just absolutely fascinating. So, you know, I guess, you know, probably as a financial, you know, very conservative person financially, you know, coming kind of from that gold, you know, that gold-based certainty, you know, understanding of the financial system, there's probably times I look at something like Bitcoin as, you know, well, you know, the network is far more secure. You know, the computer processing of the Bitcoin network, you know, really creates ultimate, you know, security of the ledger, which is what, you know, the decentralized nature of the proof of work was supposed to do. And I probably don't share that same view of the ultimate security of the Ethereum ledger. But that said, you know, the rapid innovation and sort of showing what's possible that's happening in other you know, decentralized computing ecosystems, whether it's, you know, proof of stake or Ethereum, you know, I think is showing, you know, the cultural power of the NFT, the automated market making, you know, creating new forms of governance through you know, decentralized autonomous, you know, organizations, DAOs, rather than, you know, just the equity formation or the debt formation of capital markets. I think we're seeing this wild innovation. Now, you know, like most wild innovation, I think most of those current assets are going to trend towards zero. But I think it's showing a path of how this technology can move forward. But the two things that I'd say that infrastructure, as more and more sort of, you know, value at risk is locked in this system, I think the two core pieces of infrastructure that need de-risking is identity, the actual real world identity, and matching that into the system, you know, for all the political and property rights reasons for doing so, as well as custody of these private keys, right? So I've always seen, and I've been in this market, you know, innovating. I think I wrote my first patents with a group writing our first patents in blockchain based commodities in sort of 2013. So by many terms, I'm kind of I'm one of the, you know, longer term persons in this industry, but the two parts that I think have still not been fundamentally solved is the, you know, matching someone's identity on a decentralized blockchain to their real world identity that can actually be, you know, to settle problems in the court of law in an actual sovereign jurisdiction. You know, for that title to be recognized by a state in law, you know, not just in the blockchain law, you need to tie a real world identity. And how do you do that securely without creating just an absolute honeypot of surveillance and so forth? So I'd say identity is one big problem. And then again, custody, you know, that's the other problem with a bearer instrument, is that possession becomes 10/10 of the law in many ways, right? So if I lose a private key, you know, who now owns the title? How is that title recovered? There's the purely digital world issues there, but also matching it to a real world security. Again, that's why we have all these different layers of accounting, basically, you know, the human blockchain of trading versus clearing versus settlement versus custody. You know, this whole stack is to basically manage the trust of who owns what in a very complex system. So that custody and that identity piece, I think, are the two most important piece. And I've been, you know, essentially working on both of those pieces for the last 8 years.
I want to drill into both of those, because if we think about the first big digital bearer asset system to really go big, it was Bitcoin. And what was Bitcoin designed to do? It wasn't actually designed to be anonymous. It was pseudonymous. But the whole idea was to be as close to anonymous as you could get and to thwart the ability of governments to know who the real human being was behind a particular Bitcoin address. And of course, it's not completely impossible, but they try to make it difficult. What you're saying, I think, is if we're talking about the mainstream financial system, we really have a different set of goals. We don't want to hide that. We need to be able to, in a very secure and reliable way, with certainty, verify who the legal identity is of some actor in this digital system. So tell us about this concept called self-sovereign identity, which has become something of a buzzword in this whole DeFi revolution that's going on. What's self-sovereign identity and why should we care?
Yeah, well, first I need to challenge the premise a little bit, of anonymity. I actually think it's a very important part of the broader financial ecosystem. And so, you know, while I agree with you that there's a lot of governments and there's a lot of vested interest that doesn't want that kind of power, you know, to the individual, I actually think it's an important part that's never going to go away, right? There's always going to be, you know, a sort of marginalized minority in society that sort of doesn't trust some of the intermediaries all the way up to the government, right? I'm not trying to be political. I'm not trying to choose sides in this, but I think you need to recognize that that's always going to be part of a system, right? There may be a political narrative, you know, let's talk about some of the marginalized economic activities in, say, you know, drugs and narcotics or in sex workers or various things that, you know, there are always going to be an intermediary that's going to say, you know what, I just want nothing to do with that. You know, it's just too risk. You know, whether it's morals or it's you know, the risk of somebody, you know, freezing those accounts because of, you know, political movements, there's always going to be an intermediary that just doesn't want the risk of banking or providing financial services to people on the sort of the marginalized or minority of a society. You know, looking what happened with the Canadian truckers, this is actually another perfect example. You had a group of, and I don't want to get into the core of, you know, who's really behind the truckers or anything like that. But at the end of the day, there are many legitimate protests and protesters that just don't, that believe that Canada's, that Canada's mandates have just, COVID mandates are just too strong. And it doesn't, a one size fit all mandate just doesn't work for all of the complexities of society. And so there are many legitimate protesters that are backing through GoFundMe or other sort of crowdfunding platforms, trying to put their money into the protest. And then, that the Canadian government comes out and essentially changes the rules and actually sort of suspends a lot of civil liberties, through an emergency mandate, and basically just gives banks an ability, on good faith efforts, to seize accounts and seize funds without any recourse or liability. So the political ability to use these intermediaries in the financial system for a legitimate protest, again, not getting into, who's ultimately behind the truckers. There's lots of political dynamics, but at the end of the day, there are many legitimate protesters and people trying to fund protests or support it with their, put their money where their mouth is, that really just got frozen out of political opposition. So, this is the problem with a centralized system, is you're always going to have that ability. It's really a power brokering system as much as it is an economic system.
Well, Josh, I couldn't agree more. And I have to say, I myself personally like the idea of being able to have my financial affairs be my business and not the government's business. But I'm also a realist, and I know that the trend in society is toward more trust of government, not less. And I know that governments want to control everything. So does that mean that we have completely separate digital systems where there's kind of a marginalized Bitcoin system that's for the guys that that want to do things without government knowledge, and there's a completely, totally separate parallel digital bearer asset system, which is more wired into the mainstream financial system? Or do they all operate kind of on the same network?
Well, I think they will in some ways operate on some of the shared network. And ultimately, politics is going to drive this, right? So, I do believe there, again, going back to my framework of the money itself, where certain assets, possession becomes 10 tenths the law, whether it's a dollar bill, the person that legally owns it is the one holding that bearer instrument, a Bitcoin, a bar of gold. So there are, there's always going to be people seeking that, where you don't need to trust intermediaries to make a transaction. You don't need to trust a PayPal or a GoFundMe or any other financial intermediary. So I don't think that ever goes away. Right down to the point of, bartering, even if the government tries to make it illegal, bartering for, local farm, co-ops and swaps, right? So I think there's always going to be marginalized peoples that will create systems. And so there's always going to be a demand for software intermediation between them. Now, you're absolutely right. There's going to be a lot of governments or particular philosophies within government that's always going to want to, it's going to be a constant, war and struggle, between these two groups. It always has been, and I don't see that any different. And software just becomes a tool to raise that confrontation to a greater scale. So I would say they're always going to exist, not necessarily in parallel, but sort of, they're going to be, edges of the system where they're always going to interact. But that said, I think, putting that aside, the pseudonymous transfer of a digital asset like Bitcoin, putting that aside, how do we still use other aspects of decentralized computing in a more, let's say, regulatory or government friendly way? And maybe we can take the discussion forward from there.
Well, let's start with self-sovereign identity. What does that phrase mean, and how does it play into what you just said about, the government friendly version of this?
Yeah, so if you think about the movement of a bearer, the essentially the ledger of a bearer instrument in say the Bitcoin network or one of these pseudonymous networks, is really it's about what public key matches with what private key, or you know, the unspent transactions, you know, specifically in Bitcoin, you know, available if you have that key pair. But you know, that identifier of the you know, the public key on the blockchain network, of course, is not tied to it to an individual. But if we wanted to make a, you know, a permission blockchain, you know, ultimately someone's going to have to manage the rules and permissions of tying, you know, tying identity to those long strings of digits, you know, public keys. And so this is where self-sovereign identity comes in, is creating, you know, tying a real world identity through a proof of basically a proof of ownership of that, you know, of that public private key pair. And so right now, like, one of the big problems of the internet is it always needed, you know, some people in Web3 or blockchain call it, you know, the original sin of the internet, is that there was actually no identity layer within the internet. So we created all these ways, you know, like PayPal or, you know, ultimately, you know, once we got into the cloud computing era, you know, we authenticate and we log in with Google, or we log in with Twitter or Microsoft. You know, you have all these sort of centralized identity managers that can manage, you know, manage the, you know, the ledger, or, you know, whether it's digital assets or information assets, you know, they manage, you know, who owns what within a database. And so it, you know, the internet as and IT systems as needed today, you know, you rely on central parties, you know, very much like the financial system, to manage the user password access of a person. What self-sovereign identity does is it gets away from that. It uses that same public-private key cryptography to prove, you know, certain credentials. And so, you know, the way that we're building it at ID++, you know, as an example, you know, in order to log in to your, you know, to your trading account, which in many ways, other than, you know, government, you know, regulatory reasons, you know, we actually have very little access to understanding who's trading at what time. That's managed by actually having a credential presented in a key exchange to log in. So, you know, on an actual user's you know, phone, like a digital wallet, you know, they will say, yes, I am a credentialed trader at Citibank. You know, I've gone through the onboarding process. I've got my credential of Citibank in my wallet. And because I am a member of the exchange with a credential by my institution, I can log in by presenting that Citibank credential to the Abex exchange to log in. So I believe that system of providing credentials, you know, through a much more, you know, private key held system will allow much more secure verification of identity, rather than, hey, I logged in with Google. I am who I say I am because I use my Gmail account to log in. That's not very secure, but, you know, there are systems to make that identity credential far more secure.
Well, hang on a second there, because I agree with you that just logging into Google is not terribly secure. But from a functionality standpoint, Google is beginning to give me something that I want very much. What I can do now with Google is log in once to Google, and then I can use Gmail, and I can use Google Documents, and I can use whatever other Google apps. And I'm already logged in, and it knows who I am, and I don't have to have multiple passwords. And if as soon as I have more than 5 different passwords on different systems, I'm going to start writing them down, and that compromises security. What I want to do, Josh, is I want to log in to the entire financial internet once with one username and password. Hopefully, it's going to do some kind of biometric, you know, fingerprint check or something and make goddamn sure that I really am who I say I am. And then I want that to just plain work, so I can go to any place, any financial institution, and I don't have to log into anything because I'm already logged in a secure enough way that it truly is trustworthy, which, as you say, just logging into Google is not really solving that problem. Can we get to the point where I just log in once at the beginning of the day and no financial institution has my password stored in their system, but they all trust that I am who I say I am because some larger, broader system solves that for us?
That's correct. And I think we're headed there. And I think actually we're headed there faster than people may think.
I think that whoever owns that is in what I'll call a Bloomberg position. Frankly, as a software guy, I am extremely unimpressed with the Bloomberg terminal system as a software platform. But boy, they've got market share, they've got functionality, and they've got all the data, and they completely captured market share. Nobody can touch them. I think whoever nails giving me one login to the entire financial internet that is truly secure and reliable and works with all of my financial institutions has a monopoly. Would you agree?
I would agree. And of course, well, I wouldn't say it's a monopoly, and we'll get into to where I'm going with this. But absolutely, it's going to give a lot of power to, you know, whoever has the first applications running on that. So think about, you know, think about email for a second. You know, the simple mail transfer protocol of email was very powerful. But at the end of the day, people, you know, Microsoft built a business around Microsoft Outlook and actually have an application that works, you know, works very well with that protocol. Or the same thing with you know, with Gmail or Yahoo Mail before that, right? So a very powerful system that sits on top of an open protocol. So I think that's where the identity space is headed, is that someone with the identity management software, the wallet, so to speak, that works with a financial identity protocol. I think there's going to be a lot of power in that business model. So that of course is exactly where Abex has been investing. I've been investing in that for about four to five years now, and it's going to take a long time. But you know, we are getting closer and closer to that reality, by evidence by what's happening again in DeFi and say with the, you know, MetaMask wallet or the Ethereum name service. You know, that system is actually already becoming superior. Now there's a lot of problems in interoperability. It only works in, you know, in Ethereum ecosystems, it's so forth, you know, which people are working on. But like the actual user, like the security of holding those keys is already better in the DeFi ecosystem. And the actual user experience of logging in with a MetaMask wallet or with an Ethereum name service is already better than a username password system. The only problem is it's got, in my view, a little bit of a sort of a cryptocurrency bias, you know, to always be working on Ethereum. Where I think we're headed in the future, and through efforts like the Decentralized Identity Foundation, is that we're going to be able to use multiple blockchains and present, you know, multiple credentials to log in. So the way I like to think about it is, you know, to try to use sort of a real world example, you know, say you go to a club and you forgot, or, you know, or a bar and you forgot your ID, and we can talk about for a second, like, what is an ID? but like, you know, you don't have your driver's license or your passport, you know, how do you get in? You know, you show them, oh, here's my credit card. This has my name. You know, this person can vouch for me. Let me call the owner. This person's dressed nice. They look like a lawyer. You know, let's have all these people convince the bouncer that I'm trustworthy. I meet the minimum threshold to get in. And so we're presenting all of these identifier proofs in real time. And ultimately it's that bouncer that's got a risk tolerance of, okay, what's my actual underlying risk for letting them in? Like, this person clearly is who they say they are. All these people can vouch for them. All of these other forms of identity, although they're not exactly what I'm looking for, they get me past that threshold, because what's the ultimate risk? You know, that maybe this bar loses its license if it served an underage person, right? So it becomes a risk-reward identity infrastructure where there's a risk tolerance, right? To log into a, you know, a website, you know, to look for something, you know, is probably a very low risk tolerance that I need to know who that is. If I'm going to actually transfer, you know, $50, it may need a higher risk tolerance. If I'm going to trade $500 million, it's going to have an ultimate risk, you know, a zero risk tolerance, right? So that's what, you know, decentralized identity infrastructure is ultimately going to do, is you're going to bring all of your digital proofs, all of your credentials, maybe my employment at, you know, like, you know, to use the example I use, my employment at Citibank, to get into the exchange, the fact that you've issued me an Abex credential to trade on the exchange, that I've passed my series one or my series three, et cetera, so I can now trade on this exchange. I have this education. I have this login over here on my credit card network. You know, I have this login with my utility bill, right? So I can present all of these credentials in real time, and whoever's on the other side, that bouncer, is going to make a risk assessment in real time. You know, can I let them in? Can I let them perform certain services? So instead of going from a single login where, again, Google's holding my you know, my email and password to say, yes, this person is, you know, my email at gmail.com, right? Instead of going from that system, you're going to a risk type system of the identity is who they say they are. And I think that's the key piece of infrastructure to change the entire financial system. Because then that becomes interoperable with the custody issues, right? So I need, you know, custody where it needs 7 different signatures to release these funds, 7 different auditors or regulators or internal auditors or compliance people. I can do that all if I've abstracted to a level where 7 people sign off on, say, this digital agreement that pops up on my screen, and all 7 of them present their basket of credentials, now I've made everything more secure, and I've made it more certain from a legal perspective. And all of those protocols can be designed based on a risk-based system, just like the financial system has.
Josh, I want to move on to the second major point that you made, which is custody. I don't know how you think about this, but here's my mental model of it. Almost everybody in the financial system worries about what happens when we get the next Lehman moment. Well, how do we define a Lehman moment? That is a time when there is one really big financial institution that is a custodian over so many different assets of both their own and their customers, that the counterparty risks that are embedded into the failure of that too big to fail institution could literally create this domino effect that takes down the entire financial system. My answer to that is we ought to eliminate the entire concept of too big to fail by eliminating this concept of custodianship, where there is a bank that has a bunch of counterparty risks that could break the whole financial system. That's crazy. Is there a way to solve that problem with this new technology?
Yeah, I mean, I believe there is. You know, getting back to self-sovereign identity and making sure, you know, that these keys are or these assets, you know, represented by the keys they can sign. You know, it's almost like moving, you know, a physical title certificate in and out of a bank vault where you have 4 different people that have keys to move it. So the intermediary becomes purely a vault, like, you know, literally like a, you know, using a Brinks or, you know, or one of these, you know, sort of actual logistics custodians. You know, they really become a holder of keys, you know, based on a protocol, rather than what the current system is, which is dematerialized contracts. So they're actually really is just a ledger entry of who owns what, right? And so there can be risk if they mismanage their ledger or mismanage their, you know, their risk management systems of their collateral and so forth. You know, if this firm goes under, then there became, you know, there could be this gray area where people, you know, between the beginning of the quarter and the end when they're auditing, they're kind of moving what should be a custody client asset, but they're really moving it into their own account or their own, you know, using it for their own collateral for some sort of risky trade, right? So that's the big problem in the custody ecosystem. And there's lots of ways that regulators try to make this lower risk. You know, you have to hold so much capital requirement to be a qualified custodian, you know, even in dematerialized contract custody, right? You have to hold so much cash or bonds, you know, so that, you know, if something goes wrong, you know, through a bankruptcy process, people will always get their, you know, their assets back. So that's the current system now, is that there's all these layers of risk in settlement and custody, whereas in a purely, again, 10/10 of the law, whoever owns these keys owns the title, you know, that system changes significantly to a more self-custodied system. Now, I don't believe it's fully self-custody, that the entire world's going to be running around with sort of Trezor USB keys, you know, holding their entire financial balance. Now, from a risk perspective, some people may want that, right? Going back to our Canadian trucker example, there may be some piece of the financial system, you know, very much like gold, that they want outside of the, you know, outside of the regulated infrastructure. But for the most part, I think what it's going to be is a series of identity proofs to, you know, to do something, right? A protocol where 3 different people need to sign using self-sovereign identity this transaction to release an asset from custody. You know, very much like 2 managers of the company, 2 fiduciaries have to use their bank, you know, login tokens and both digitally sign for to send an electronic payment from a corporate bank account. Like that type of infrastructure is going to happen, you know, broadly across the financial industry, you know, where you're going to have multiple signatures in order to move, you know, custody or title of this, you know, this bearer instrument from one place to another.
Josh, in the interest of playing devil's advocate here, I think some people would say, wait a minute, there is not necessarily universal benefit to a 10-tenths of the law system. Because for some things, yeah, I really want it to be an absolute transfer of custody. And, you know, once I've got it, I've got it. Nobody can take it away. But, you know, when I buy something on my credit card, I kind of like having the security of knowing that, yeah, I agreed to, I gave them my credit card number. I agreed to buy whatever it was. But if it turns out that it was a scam and they lied to me about what they were selling me, or they never shipped me the product or whatever, I can call the credit card company up and they can unwind that transaction through the chargeback mechanism and say, okay, Mr. Sleaze seller, unless you can prove that you actually delivered the product you were supposed to deliver, we're going to give this guy his money back. We're going to take it out of your merchant account and you don't have to like it. Do we still need to have those kinds of mechanisms in a new 10-tenths of the law based custody system?
I believe we do, but I think they'll just look as like something different. And actually, the credit card example is a perfect one, because you're absolutely right. There's an aspect of insurance within that system that, you know, ultimately the merchants are paying, you know, 3% plus you know, interchange, you know, base fees on every transaction for that consumer to have that insurance, right? So you know, one of the big questions for, you know, kind of for society is how much cost, you know, is that imposing, you know, particularly, you know, it really is a regressive system, right? You know, people that actually have, you know, higher balances on their credit card, you know, are actually, you know, get paid cash back, you know, to borrow money, right? Particularly in like basically zero interest rate environments. But there's a insurance tax, you know, sort of spent, you know, on the rest of the merchant economy for that. And, you know, these big credit card companies and these networks, they've actually got very, very good, and it no longer costs 3% insurance per transaction, you know, to actually provide that service to the user. These companies now have 60, 70% gross margins. So they've actually, you know, through operating cost efficiency and insurance, they've lowered their actual cost to provide that service, yet they still capture this massive part of the transaction. Where in many industries, you know, you look at some retail food industries, you know, you look at, you know, a lot of retail toys and so forth, the margin on that payment insurance becomes higher than the margin of the actually industry it's serving. And that becomes very problematic, particularly if you're talking about cross-border and you're adding another 2.5 to 3% in cross, you know, in foreign transaction fees within that system. It could cost you 6-7% overall for that convenience of having some chargeback risk. So, you know, I guess the big question is, do we have better technology systems than just paying Visa and MasterCard, you know, a very high margin in oligopolistic networks for that user experience? And I think, again, that's a perfect aspect of software disintermediation. Anytime there's those types of models, software is going to come back at it. And again, what is that transaction that you talked about? What is that actually doing? It's identity insurance, right? That's what that card network is doing, is basically saying, yes, this person, you know, made this transaction. They are who they said they are. And so I'm going to debit their account and, you know, and give it to the merchant's account. And of course, there's a sort of four-party system. So that risk is spread through this whole, you know, the merchant acquirers, the, you know, the card networks, the, you know, the bank issuers. So it's this whole system to spread that risk. But ultimately, what is the risk? It's the identity. It's the identity in the ledger. So I think that there's, you know, with better identity, a lot of that, those card networks do go away over time.
Josh, let's tie this back into how it's going to work. What does it look like? Does that mean that if I want to buy something in the future, the website or whatever is going to tell me, well, this particular transaction is offered as a 10-tenths of the law. Once you've paid your money, you're never going to see it again. But this other one has the ability to challenge the transaction if you don't like it after the fact? Or will this be, you know, all legislated and mandated by governments? And if so, how does that work across international boundaries? Because, you know, the internet is a global place. It seems like there's a lot of issues to work out here.
Absolutely there is. And I think, you know, I think that's where, you know, so many securities laws and consumer protection laws came from, was, you know, more and more, you know, individuals getting involved in these systems and where those potentials for conflict of interest or fraud, you know, comes from. So I generally agree with you that we're not going to move to a fully, you know, possession of keys, 10 tenths of the law system. I still believe that people are going to want the security and the user interface, or you know, just better operating protocols of an intermediary. I just think they won't take so much, you know, cut of the transaction. So that, you know, I don't believe we're going to be running around with, you know, with USB sticks, you know, where we keep all of our life savings. I think we're still going to trust intermediaries. We're just going to have a lot more checks and balances on the ability to withdraw or move assets. You know, one of the, you know, I was talking to a bank CEO, you know, many years ago in the early days of, you know, getting involved in this infrastructure. And one of the things that they said, you know, one of their biggest, you know, retail advantages is nobody likes changing bank accounts, right? And the main reason is resetting up, you know, their automatic bill pays, you know, resetting up their, you know, the onboarding of a bank onboarding and proving, you know, all of the things you need to prove to onboard to a bank. This is usually something that becomes very sticky. People stick with their banks forever. However, if you remove some of the ability, you know, the ability to very quickly through a couple key transactions, you know, prove your identity to a new bank or a new service provider, or a new custodian, you can very quickly move assets. And really the financial institutions, you know, one of the main things that they, you know, one of their main business models is gathering assets, right? Getting paid for custody, getting paid to be able to lend it, getting paid for consumer lending. So the customer acquisition versus lifetime value equation of a bank is to always be gathering individuals and always be gathering assets. Now, if you now have a system where you can very quickly move your assets to different intermediaries that make your life a little bit more secure than holding your own private keys, then you just create an incentive and a check and balance for those intermediators to serve you better, right? Whether you're the, you know, capital provider or the capital receiver. And so that's ultimately what software is going to do, is provide a quicker check and balance to make sure incentives are aligned.
I want to talk now about what this means here and now to investors who want to be part of this long-term story. And boy, it is a very complex and confusing roadmap that we see ahead. You know, if I draw an analogy back to the mid to late 90s, when everybody in finance had figured out that the internet was going to be a really big deal, but almost nobody in finance really had an accurate understanding of what that really meant. So all of a sudden, everybody is overpaying for pets.com. They don't really know what to buy. They just want to buy something with .com in its name. Eventually, we figured out, if we have the benefit of hindsight, well, a company like Google that comes along and does something seemingly fairly simple. All they're doing is providing a search mechanism to help you find stuff on the internet. In the beginning, they weren't providing any apps of their own or anything. It was just a way to find stuff. Well, that was so fundamental. Everybody needed to find where things were. And more importantly, it put Google in the driver's seat to influence who was at the top of the list when you were searching for those things. There were dozens and dozens of different search sites on the internet. Somehow Google became the Coca-Cola of search sites, and that created an empire. The other big thing I would say, looking back, was Jeff Bezos was not really trying to sell books back when he opened his online bookstore. He was trying to create the foundational platform that would eventually allow him to create this e-commerce empire of selling just about everything on the internet. So an e-commerce platform and a search platform turned out to be probably the best two investments you could have made in the late 90s in order to be part of this internet revolution. As we look ahead, it sounds like you're saying self-sovereign identity is one of those, you know, like the search engine. It's a very simple thing, but it's so foundational, it's really important. What are the other things to avoid pets.com and to get into the Amazons and the Googles of the next 25 years? What are the things that are going to be foundational and most important to this digital bearer asset revolution that's coming?
Yeah, you know, it is very difficult. Again, I've kind of staked, you know, around self-sovereign identity and custody and the way the user interface and that how you can help users, you know, through those tools is really where I've been focused. You know, I think there are going to be interesting protocols, again, looking at DeFi, you know, marketplaces, you know, for NFTs, and really what NFTs, really what they are is, you know, it's bringing a community into a financial network. So, you know, I think there's a lot of aspects of this that are going to be very interesting. But ultimately, the infrastructure, I just always come back to identity and custody as being the key pieces to balance a sovereign nation state world with a purely digital world, right? I think those are the two pieces and a lot of the software around that. But I would also say, you know, a lot of the service providers around machine learning and natural language processing, you know, quote unquote, artificial intelligence, I think the ability to manage all of this data and metadata that's going to be in these blockchain ecosystems, you know, the composability of different pieces of data is going to be, you know, a key piece of all of this. And so I would say that's another place to probably invest. And of course, the bridges, you know, the people that are actually taking this new, you know, call it Web3 world and bridging it and unlocking the, you know, the trillions upon trillions in the Web2 or even Web1, you know, local server custodied world of big finance. You know, there's all this experimentation happening in almost a completely separate ecosystem. There's a few bridges in stable coins and so forth, but for the most part, you've got an almost completely independent, sort of sandbox of decentralized finance happening in one place with, you know, some, maybe it's now, you know, tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars, but now you're talking about, you know, many decatrillions of dollars in the formal financial system. So those that have the bridge between the two and allow money to flow between the two, you know, with some sort of service fee or SaaS application fee, you know, I think that's another place to invest. And of course, that's where Abex is investing by launching a more formal commodity exchange, but slowly introducing a lot of these ancillary products, you know, to bridge the worlds. That's where we've, you know, and look, full disclosure, you know, we're not there yet. We've been investing for 4 years and thinking about this, testing it, building systems, you know, but we actually have not launched our core piece of it, which is our exchange, to allow some of those systems to flow. So you know, for us, it's a big long-term investment. And I think I think it's investing around some of the service applications around self-sovereign identity. And this is tough, right? It's very different than a winner-take-all market. And going back to your examples of Google and Amazon, at the end of the day, they're both markets, right? What was the transformational event in Google's history that made them more powerful than anybody else? It was actually, in my view, it was the acquisition of AdSense and creating a marketplace for ads rather than necessarily their, you know, all of their algorithms providing the best thing to the top. They allowed markets to service things to the best to the top. Now, there's a lot of problems. You know, their market is very different than the New York Stock Exchange, and many would argue it's almost a rigged market in their ad exchanges between them and Facebook, right? So, and they're taking 30% of the cut of these markets rather than 3 basis points. So I think there's a lot of problems in the market of Google, but that, you know, ultimately was a market that gave Google power. Same thing with Amazon, right? You know, Jeff Bezos, you know, first he really decided, you know, the many SKUs of books was the perfect e-commerce platform to provide all sorts of different SKUs in electronic format, and organize those SKUs much better than the SKUs of a bookstore and knowing what inventory to hold. And he was able to revolutionize e-commerce and ultimately, you know, distributed computing because he wanted that big marketplace to be up and always available and not dropping. So he eventually also, you know, created Amazon Web Services. So it was really markets that drove all. So we still believe that markets will drive all, and being in those marketplace points of this transition is still the most valuable. And you've even seen that in Bitcoin, right? Like with, you know, with FTX and with Coinbase, the marketplace is still the place that's driving the transition.
Josh, it sounds like your answer to Amazon search is the newfangled thing that needs to be a foundational technology is self-sovereign identity. You guys are addressing that at Abex with ID++. And with respect to the Amazon, if you will, I think what you've done is rather than try to take on the stock market, which is everybody's going to try to do that, and it's not really your background, you're saying commodities market, which you know better than anybody, you're going to look at re-engineering a commodities exchange using this new technology. analogy. But you're a big boy. You know that our investors who are professionals probably are invested as I am. And in the interest of full disclosure, I do have a seven-figure investment in your company, Abex Technology. So I want to make sure that that is fully disclosed to our listeners. But investors like diversification. They want to be in, not bet on one horse and make sure, especially for something like this, that they're exposed to all of the potential winners. What are the other areas of this market, including those that Abex is not directly involved with, that if you're serious about DeFi, you just have to invest in?
I probably don't invest a lot. I mean, I probably make three trades outside of my own businesses. I've always sort of invested in my own businesses. So I'm probably not the best to, do any sort of stock picking. But I will say that there are companies that I think truly get this. I would say, one of them is Jack Dorsey's Block, which used to be Square, and the things that they've done in Cash App and the things that they're trying to do in self-sovereign identity, as well as, essentially more organized DeFi. Now, certainly anyone that's followed what Jack is doing since he's left Twitter. In fact, he even wants to build a version of self-sovereign identity-based, decentralized Twitter. So he's actually going to go disrupt his own business there as well, or his own creation there. But I think they're onto something. I think they're looking at it right. Now, they take a very Bitcoin-centric view of this ecosystem, for good or bad. But I think they understand the fundamentals probably as well as anybody. So I would certainly, take a look at what Block is doing and what Blue Sky Ventures is doing TBD, I forget which one, but what they're doing in decentralized social media. So that's definitely one. I think Microsoft has been doing some very, very good work in self-sovereign identity. And of course, they've got some of the biggest identity networks in the world. They have LinkedIn, they have GitHub, they have the enterprise authentication services with Active Directory. So I think they're very much in a good place, but as we all know, Microsoft tends to always hold on to something, maybe through their .NET infrastructure or otherwise. There's always some piece that they always try to hold back from being truly open source. But, that said, I think they're doing really good work in that area. I do think MasterCard understands where this world's headed and some of the risks to the interchange system. MasterCard has been investing, I think, quite heavily in self-sovereign identity and new identity systems. I'd say Workday. Workday has been investing in these ecosystems. I've seen some hints that even with Slack and some of the new acquisitions through Salesforce, I think ultimately they'll head this way probably before others. So and Avast Security just bought a credential issuing platform. There's a few out there, particularly on the identity space. But I'll probably leave it to a buy or sell side analyst to really go into the details here.
Well, Josh, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I know you've written not only patents, but also some white papers talking about this. You've done a lot of work on this. For people who want to learn more about all this DeFi stuff and where it's headed, why don't we start with your works, but also beyond your own writings, where should people go and what should they do to learn more about this?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. First off, we did start Smarter Markets exactly for this reason, and of course, you were a big part of
Smarter Markets is your podcast.
Yeah, sorry, the Smarter Markets podcast. So I believe it's just smartermarketspod.com, or just Google Smarter Markets. And so, we do have a number of series that we're breaking down a lot of these components. And that is sort of the idea, is over time, build almost a series of white papers through these types of discussions. And I think you had a number of, excellent ones, like with Charlie Magaro, which I mentioned earlier. So, we're going to continue that type of open sourcing of information. So instead of really always pitching Abex, we just want this information to sort of come to the top and build a better, smarter markets. That really is what that's all about. We will over time release more and more information and white papers, a Git book on ID++. We're not quite ready to do that yet. It will be coming. But right now, of course, there are a lot of proprietary aspects to what we're doing. But be rest assured, smarter markets and open sourcing this type of information is a key part of what we're doing. And when we're ready to do that from our specific type protocols. That will all be, you know, very open source ecosystem, you know, probably by, you know, the end of 2022.
Josh, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com. Diversify your portfolio with U.S. farmland, one of the most inflation-protected and recession-resilient asset classes in the world, now available to all accredited investors. Listeners, we're going to leave it there for this week's show since Patrick is off and we don't have a postgame segment. Patrick will be back next week with another of his epic postgame chart books.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.